Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm well.
I'm happy to be talking about movies with friends.
Last week, we wrapped up Summer at the Multiplex. This week, we're going to be talking about the summer of Netflix. For starters, we're going to ask which of these movies, which represent Netflix's most hours watched over the first weekend of release, you've heard of. Not seen, but heard of. Here we go. The Gray Man, Hustle, Me Time, Senior Year, Day Shift, The Man from Toronto, Look Both Ways, Purple Hearts, Interceptor, Spiderhead, and The Sea Beast. Now, I've heard of seven of those movies. I mean, I'm a professional critic. I've heard of seven of those movies. I've only actually watched three of them, and I am out of the ordinary. Again, out of the ordinary, I do this for a living, but I'm not sure which way I'm out of the ordinary here. Am I out of the ordinary in the sense that I've watched and heard of more of these movies than the average moviegoer or fewer? No idea. I can't tell. I can't help but think that the cultural memory of those pictures is smaller than the memory of the summer's biggest box office openings. Here's that list. Here's the top 10 box office openings. You got Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness, Jurassic World Dominion, Thor, Love and Thunder, Top Gun Maverick, Minions, Rise of Gru, Lightyear, Nope, Elvis, Bullet Train, and The Black Phone. I've both heard of and seen all of these. Again, I'm out of the ordinary here because this is just my job. That's what I do. But all told, I would be willing to bet a decent amount of money that more people have heard of these movies than have heard of the Netflix programmers. Who knows how many people have gone to see either of them? Don't know. But I think just in terms of what people have heard of, the theatrical experience kicks the butt of the Netflix experience. So here is the big question then for movie stars, at least insofar as we still have movie stars. Would you rather take the big check from Netflix that covers not only your upfront salary, but also like whatever sort of back end profit points that they have to buy out to get you to come do it, right? Or would you rather take less money up front from a theatrically oriented distributor, but also get the sort of brand awareness boost that comes with being in a huge publicity campaign, TV ads, billboards, theatrical trailers, et cetera, in order to stay in the public spotlight for longer? Alyssa, what's the point of being a movie star if nobody knows you're in a movie?
So there's money. There's yachts and private jets and jewels and dresses and tuxedos if you're a tuxedo wearing person, and nannies for your children and lots of freebies and chocolates and private chefs and private jet travel. But
stuff,
yes,
is what you're saying.
Money, like the money and the things that you buy with it and the random stuff that you get for free for being a rich and famous person. But really, that's the point of doing a movie with Netflix, right? Is not, not because you think you are making cinema that is going to be seen by a wide audience and embraced by everybody, but because you're willing to, be showered by the fruits of the algorithm. And that's fine, right? I mean, like wanting to make a lot of money in a way that doesn't involve, exploiting third world children or destroying the environment is not the worst thing in the world. I mean, it's
pluses and minuses.
Indeed. But I think if you are going into cinema because you want to act and connect with people and make movies that will be at the center of the conversation and also possibly like become famous and adored yourself, Netflix, I think, increasingly is not going to be the venue that helps you deliver on that ambition.
Right. So, I mean, I feel like obviously the money is a big deal, right? If you are somebody who is offered, estimates vary, but between $20 and $40 million to star in one of these movies, which is what like a legit A-list star can get to star in them. Fine. Money is all well and good. But again, like, if you are a movie star, the reason you are a movie star is because lots of people know you and talk about you and seek you out, want to see you, et cetera, et cetera. And I can't help but feel that the whole Netflix thing, which is basically Netflix is the place people go, it's the homepage of their entertainment evenings on Friday night, kind of negates you as a star in terms of star power. And like, can you maintain that sort of paycheck if you are just showing up on Netflix films and you're there?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are obviously stars that have decided to treat Netflix as the ecosystem, right? I mean, if you're Adam Sandler, what you do is you make movies for Netflix now. Like, Mark Wahlberg has a big deal with them and clearly just like part of his career now is making Netflix movies almost as a genre. But, you know, I mean, I think there's a reason that you don't see, like, Meryl Streep making movies for Netflix. You don't see, you know, a star director like Steven Spielberg making movies for Netflix. It's because I think for many, many of the public people in the entertainment industry, the movie making is fundamentally a communal product, right? I mean, there's a reason that, like, Nicole Kidman is, like, putting on her sparkly pinstripe suit and going to AMC. They want to make movies that are going to be experienced communally, that are going to be discussed on some sort of communal schedule. And they don't want to make stuff that feels disposable, right? And increasingly stuff on Netflix is not marketed. It's not necessarily fed to everybody on the home screen. There is no guarantee that if something comes out on Netflix on a given weekend that it's going to be watched by a large number of people in that period who then, you know, come to work on Monday ready to talk about it around the water cooler. I have come to think of Netflix as an incredibly effective machine for generating loneliness. And I suspect that if you're a movie star, you sense that and worry about what it means, you know, for your own sort of import and ability to reach a lot of people at once and foster that sort of communal conversation, but also because you maybe don't feel so great about being just converted into product, right? And, you know, being used to stock the Amazon store, which will be then used to keep people alone on their couches on Friday night, sated into something approximating pleasure.
Peter, I'm going to come to you in one second, but I just want Alyssa to drill down on this idea of loneliness as a product here, because it's interesting. I haven't heard you talk about this before. So when you say loneliness as a product, what exactly do you mean? I mean, are you talking about, like, getting away from loneliness?
No, I'm talking what Netflix does is both exploits and magnifies your own loneliness and then gets you to pay for the privilege of having it magnified and having yourself sort of stuck in this loneliness loop, right? I mean, we've talked and I've written about how, you know, the binge watch model has sort of destroyed the communal watching and discussion experience for pop culture for the most part. You know, the idea, if everyone is going to be watching stuff on demand on their own schedules, you know, I have run the numbers on this. If you look at the Google search trends for Netflix shows versus shows that are released weekly, the shape of them is staggeringly different in Google search results. Netflix shows sort of peak and then disappear from the conversation. There's no sort of lingering communal effect. Whereas with something like Game of Thrones, you got, you know, or Breaking Bad or Mad Men, you got a rise up at the beginning of a season, something that sort of looks like a plateau for weeks as the season goes on, and then a dip. You could see that people were having an extended communal experience together, but the binge model has fragmented that. And then the Netflix algorithm does that even further, right? I mean, it creates a situation where everyone can have exactly the content they want when they want it. People aren't even advertised the same things at the same time, right? Like, the Netflix home screen is increasingly a personalized experience that is intended to serve you more of what you like, regardless of what else is happening in pop culture at the time, regardless of what anyone else might like. There is no, you know, Netflix is not designed to say, hey, this is the show that other people are watching. Let's catch you up so you can do it together, right? That might sort of once have been its function, where shows could become hits over time because people would binge the back catalog on Netflix and then get into the schedule of a weekly release. But that's simply not the way the streaming and, you know, linear ecosystem work together anymore. And so, you know, what Netflix does is it counts on the fact that you are lonely and you want to be entertained. And then it offers you that entertainment in a way that makes it easier to sit in your loneliness. And be asynchronous with other people, be out of the conversation. It strips away all of the social effects that used to flow from pop culture. And that has made it, I think, successful in terms of filling the immediate hours that lots of people need filled, but it makes it much, much worse at filling all of the rest of the hours that we used to fill ourselves with conversations and debates and arguments about pop culture.
Peter, that's pretty deep.
Does Netflix make people lonely on an industrial scale? I just don't see that it's all that different from stuff that came before. In the 1800s, there were literally concerns about young women spending too much time reading Jane Austen novels because, like, they were, you know, because, and they were just, like, getting, they were out of touch with reality. They didn't have any social life. They were, like, getting, they were just getting lost in their own heads. There were moral panics about pinball.
They wanted love matches.
Right. Like, all of this stuff. I spent my teenage years reading novels that were just designed to please my particular interests and watching movies that nobody else was watching on VHS at home, kind of binge watching them, right? This is what I did. I was like, and you know, I was a little bit of a lonely, nerdy kid. It was okay. Netflix is not doing something new here. It's not taking people away in a new way. It's just a different way of delivering entertainment. But I think I agree with you in a different way, certainly about the, like, what movie stars should be doing. And maybe I can tie these points together. Let's see if I can do this. So to me, the issue is, like, if you look at those, the Netflix top 10 movies, that the list that Sonny read off, and then you look at the box office top 10 movies, the clear difference is that the box office top 10 is dominated by recognizable IP. So even the biggest, like, non-IP film is Nope. And Nope is a Jordan Peele film, right? Like, there's a clear product there that they are selling you. Like, this is part of something that a lot of people know what a Jordan Peele movie is and want to go see that already. Elvis, right? Elvis is already a widely known pop culture phenomenon. So even the non-IP films there are kind of partaking in existing IP or in stuff that is known. And so the way you get successful IP is that you market it and you get people talking about it. And Netflix doesn't have successful IP because they don't do marketing and then they don't get people talking. And so this, like, there is sort of a chicken and an egg problem here, which is that, like, without the marketing, they're not going to have the cultural cachet. And without the cultural cachet, they're not going to have IP because their stuff is forgettable. They also, I think, explicitly design their movies and their shows to be kind of forgettable. Their whole model, if you go back a couple of years, you know, when we were first talking about peak TV, their whole model was, we want to just sort of feed every niche. Right. And what that means is they can't develop a coherent brand identity in the way that that HBO or A24 or Vertigo Comics developed a coherent brand identity. What does a Netflix movie or a Netflix series feel like? You can't describe it. You can't say, right? Sometimes it's Sandman and sometimes it's House of Cards and sometimes it's, you know, some kids show or reality. Sometimes it's like, is it cake? I have no idea. Like, what ties those things together is that Netflix owns all of them. That's it. There's nothing else. And so I think Netflix, the problem with Netflix isn't that it makes people lonely. The problem with Netflix is that its business model feeds them stuff that is intentionally disposable and that is designed as a commodity, both in the way that they market it, in the way that they the way that they commission programs and the way that they roll them out so that they have no sort of cultural lift and traction. And what that means is I don't think that's like creating loneliness, but what it's doing is it's creating a kind of cinematic or televisual empty calorie system in which you're not getting anything out of the stuff that you're watching because there's nothing that's designed for you to not remember it 2 months later unless, you know, there's another season on. Oh, I guess I'll spend a couple of days watching it this week. And so for stars, that presents a real problem because the only way you can get paid big money by Netflix is if you are already a big brand, which means you need to be associated with something that is big and marketed and has a cultural footprint before you get to Netflix. Will Smith gets a giant paycheck for Bright on Netflix. Adam Sandler gets a giant paycheck for doing whatever for those movies. But somebody who doesn't already have a brand name can't build one on Netflix. And that ultimately is going to create problems with them when it comes to talent, and because talent is going to, like, they're going to be stuck with second rate talent, except in some cases where they can just buy, you know, sort of where they can just overpay for stuff. And so I think what I would say is that I don't think Netflix is trafficking in loneliness or making people more lonely than any other kind of solitary stay at home, get lost in fiction medium is. What I do think they're doing is delivering a lot of stuff that ultimately leaves no impact, not just on the culture, but on the individuals consuming them. Because the individuals don't, unlike the sci-fi novels that I read as a kid, unlike, you know, the Quentin Tarantino movies that I watched 100 times over, man, I must have seen Reservoir Dogs like 100 times before I was 18 years old. Just like that movie's just completely burned into my head. And I don't know if I've watched it in 10 years because I've seen it so many times, right? Like I spent a lot of time, you know, sort of obsessively watching and rewatching things, you know, 90s version of binge culture. And I just think this sort of thing is I don't know, it's fine. It's weird to watch Reservoir Dogs 100 times, to be clear, but it's fine. And so, but Netflix is making something that no one will watch 100 times and be talking about 20 years later. And they're doing it by design, and that's going to cost them in the long run.
Well, and the other person, the other group that it's going to cost is the star, right, Peter? Because if you're you focused on the main problem here for the movie star, which is that Netflix cannot make you a movie star, but Netflix can pay movie stars that already exist exorbitant sums to be in their stuff. But if you start paying those stars to get out of the cinematic, the film theatrical distribution ecosystem and stay only in Netflix, you risk destroying that whole ecosystem anyway, which will just then create a system where Netflix never has to pay anybody more than like $500,000 to be in a movie, because like every, you're all basically the same. You're all just content for the Netflix consumer. And I mean, I really feel like there's an almost predatory aspect to overpaying Jamie Foxx like $40 million or whatever to be in Day Shift.
I don't think it's predatory. I actually think that Netflix will come to regret this strategy, because the only place where they make movies that are extremely differentiated is their Oscar bait stuff that comes at the end of the year, like Roma and, you know, Mank and that sort of thing. But everything else is so commodified, right? It's so just like, we just need this to hit the kind of target genre beats, and like, it'll, you know, sort of it fits, like this is the genre that it fits in, so it has to feel like, oh, it's a vampire movie, right? There's no twist, there's no cleverness, there's no sort of attempt to make it be something more than just like exercises in box checking, with some exceptions. I'm obviously generalizing here, and I think that in the long run, that's going to make Netflix less essential. And they sort of bet that they would be, that like being, their essentialness would come from being first and being biggest. But in a world of heavy streaming competition where the other streamers have big IP and also a commitment to a kind of quality, I think even Disney Plus, as much as I often, you know, sort of find their stuff frustrating, is aiming for a sort of cinematic vision of television with their Marvel and Star Wars shows that Netflix doesn't really ever quite get to. That means that those other streamers that have built-in IP, that have attempts at higher quality stuff, even if they don't always work, are that like Netflix becomes the thing that people can cancel in a world of 4, 5, 6, 7 streamers, and that this makes Netflix's, you know, total subscriber problems persist over the long run here.
Alyssa, we're running along here, so parting thoughts on this topic.
Yeah, I think Peter is wrong about the extent to which Netflix has disrupted the structure of the entertainment experience, just in the sense that, like, a lot of these, you know, sort of moral panics about people going down into rabbit holes on this kind of pop culture are because that cultural experience was communal, right? I mean, you can't be concerned that like too many girls are reading Jane Austen and demanding love matches unless a lot of women are reading Jane Austen simultaneously. You know, something like, Alexandre Dumas' serial novels, had this sort of distinct communal structure. You knew when they were going to be published. You read them at the time. You discussed them with people. You waited for the next cliffhanger. You know, what Netflix has done is distinct, not just in the sense that it has created content that people can get sort of obsessed with to the extension of other things, but it has disrupted the structures in which it works, right? It has taken away the episodic and sort of linear and co-synchronous nature of the television viewing experience. It has sort of stripped away the idea of a mass market box office. And that's what makes it, not that the stuff that it makes is so engaging that it takes you away from the real world, but that it entertains you in a way that deliberately takes you away from art as a communal experience.
All right. This isn't really a controversy or notroversy, so we don't have an exit question there. But think about this, movie stars who are listening to this. Think about what you're doing with your career into the industry. You got to be careful with that Netflix money. You never know. All right. Make sure to tune in for our bonus episode this Friday, in which we're going to celebrate 10 years of the indie distributor A24. Speaking of which, on to the main events. Bodies, bodies, bodies. Bearing the vaunted A24 label, Bodies, Bodies, Bodies is a combo horror, thriller, and murder mystery movie with a TikTok patina. Think of it as a R-rated Gen Z Clue, and you have some idea what you're getting into. Spoilers from here on out. So if you're waiting to see it in theaters, you better do it quick, because it's not going to be there much longer. It'll be on VOD, I believe September 27th is when it drops on Apple and Amazon and elsewhere. And then the physical media release a couple weeks after that, so... If you're waiting for that, tune out now. Spoilers coming up. All right, so the movie is like this. Socialite and addict in recovery Sophie, who's played by Amanda Stenberg, brings her new girlfriend, Bea, who's played by Maria Bakalova, to a mansion to wait out an incoming hurricane with a group of friends. It's a hurricane party, folks. The mansion is owned by the parents of David, who's played by Pete Davidson, and the friends are various forms of aimless post-millennial young people. You've got Alice, who's played by Rachel Sennett. She has a podcast. And she brought her date, too. She brought a date, too. The older than the rest of them, Greg, played by Lee Pace. There's Emma, who's played by Chase Suey Wonders. She's a bit of a drama queen. And then there's Jordan, who's played by Mahala Harold. I'm sorry, I'm horribly butchering her name. But she's an ice queen, not a drama queen. Drugs and alcohol and power outages form a potent mix when, in the midst of a party game, one of the characters shows up dead. The remaining girls and guys have to figure out who is picking them off one by one. More importantly, they have to figure out how to handle their various social pathologies and learn that buzzwords like gaslight and silencing and triggering are no defense against the cruelty of the real world. We live in an era of the so-called social thriller, right? Pictures like Get Out, Candyman, this week's Barbarian, which we're probably not going to review, Alyssa, I think that's on her no-fly list. But they have a pronounced political agenda in addition to trying to frighten audiences, right? And I don't think it's unreasonable to say that most of those pictures have a relatively straightforward progressive bent. Nope, that's just the world in which we live. What makes Bodies, Bodies, Bodies so interesting, at least to me, is that it takes the social thriller model and essentially inverts it, using progressive cliches against the characters in a way that really demonstrates their utter absurdity and the ways in which they use essentially these terms as shields to claim grievances that in turn heighten their own privilege. It's very funny. It's a weird little trick that anybody who has been on social media for any amount of time will recognize. In my review, I wrote that it's both the meanest and the funniest movie of the summer. There's a great 10 or 15 minute sequence in the last third or so of the picture that just involves the girls engaging in this sort of competitive intra-class struggle that all upper class people have always engaged in. The modern elite mindset is no less competitive now than it was during the 1980s New York City of American Psycho or the Georgian era of Jane Austen. But just as Patrick Bateman's goals were different from the goals of the Bennets, so too are those of this Gen Z clatch from generations prior. It's just that modern competition revolves around the ability to claim persecution in a land of modern strivers. Granted, wealth and power, the likes of which the world has rarely seen, she who can lay claim to the greatest number of handicaps and the lowest number of privileges is queen victim and therefore the winner. As always, I worry that I enjoyed these pictures because I agreed with it rather than it was good. But the audience I saw it with was totally into it. I don't know. It seems like a place for everyone. Peter, what did you make of Bodies, Bodies, Bodies?
I really liked it. And I think you are correct to zero in on this movie being about language policing and the abuse of language in online, the use and abuse of of language in online discourse. There is, at the very beginning of the movie, not very beginning, it's 15 minutes or so into the movie, there's like a Pete Davidson monologue in which he picks out, what's the word that he says? But he's just like, oh, it's gaslighting, right? And he's just like, you don't know what this means. It doesn't actually mean anything when you say it. It's just an internet word that people just repeat because everybody else says it on Twitter. And it's sort of like a state the theme moment, except that it's not just your sort of typical, like, 5 minutes into the movie, we say what it's going to be about. It's like, no, this is the movie's prevailing ethos. It's about the ways that language gets abused and used, like, I think you're exactly right, as a shield, as a weapon, and in order to tear other people down, often because the people using those words are deeply insecure and kind of awful themselves. And you've argued that this is reactionary. I don't think that that's wrong. But what I think it is this is the, like, the leading edge of what I think is going to be over the next couple of years, a youth Gen Z backlash to bad progressive internet discourse culture and the kind of language policing and class infighting that goes, privilege mongering that goes with all of this. Because the internet has spent the last 5 or 10 years setting up like a really sort of unpleasant system of discourse policing, in which there's a lot of things that you can't say and a lot of ways that you have to behave and act and, you comport yourself, in which people can sort of use this, like you said, these tricks to win arguments. And when you're 15 or 20 years old, if you're not already, like, if you're not a sort of a conformist who just goes along, and you hear that there's a bunch of words that you shouldn't say and a bunch of ideas that are deeply dangerous and corrosive to society, and then you start talking about, like, sort of making fun of those ideas, playing around with them with your friends, and you realize we can just do this and it's funny and it gets a reaction out of people, then what is the thing that you end up starting to do? And you see this already all over sort of often kind of scuzzy and unpleasant internet forums, is that the sort of, I don't want to call it punk rock, but like the scuzzy underbelly of internet discourse has already gotten there, is that they have decided that they are just going to, in a doubly, triply, like, backlash, sort of backflip ironic way, do all of the things that the discourse says you can't do. And they're going to do them semi-seriously, but also completely unseriously. And you're not allowed to, like, they won't tell you which they're doing at any given point, and that's the whole point of it. And this movie is like the first kind of mainstream thing to do that. And what I found interesting is seeing this at a, in Washington, D.C., not exactly like, some sort of small conservative town, right? At the Alamo Draft House, on a weekend show with a bunch of people who were all, mostly 40 and under. Like, they watched this and they clearly sort of felt seen and enjoyed it. And there was, like, this is, I think that this movie, like, I both liked the movie as a movie, but I also think that it is a sort of, it's an on the edge of, like, where culture is going to go kind of social statement. Because if you want to genuinely be edgy right now, if you want people to, or you want people to think you are, then the way to do it is to say that all of this sort of language police, all of this sort of, here, the manners that you were supposed to have and the beliefs that you're supposed to have, most of which are sort of left-leaning progressive, all of that stuff is nonsense and stupid, and we're just going to do whatever we want. And this is the movie that sort of that takes that and turns it into a really funny, really mean, appropriate length mystery about why people are dying.
Yeah, the sense I had in my theater was one of intense catharsis, just like watching this happening on screen and laughing at it and being like, yes, this is all ridiculous. I'm glad we can all highlight that. Alyssa, how did you feel watching Bodies, Bodies, Bodies?
I think y'all are overstating the goodness of this movie for two key reasons. I think the first is that this would be a stronger movie. So there are sort of two things that are going on in the movie in terms of the critique of kind of zennial. I think is it zennial? Is that accurate culture?
Zennial is elder millennials, right?
We've got, no,
it's
sorry.
Gen Z.
Gen Z, the Gen Z millennial border, right there.
So there's sort of the influence of social media and the desire to be sort of seen and display yourself or podcast. And then there is the way that a specific kind of social justice language is weaponized. And the action in the movie turns out, the funniest scenes in the movie come from the sort of mockery of the language and way of talking and thinking about every sort of minor interpersonal drama or unhappiness as, you know, a trauma or a matter of justice or a trigger. But the actual action ends up being driven by social media, right? I mean, like, there's no serial killer. There's just, like, a dumbass who wants to make a TikTok video with...
Spoilers!
We said spoilers. I can talk about, you know... I mean, yeah. So it ends up being... There's sort of, like, a little bit of a disconnect between the phenomena that is sort of getting the headlines and the phenomena that actually drives the plot, right? I mean, like... This is sort of a funnier movie. This is a sharper movie to me. If the action ends up being driven by, like, the sort of language that's at issue, right? In the way of sort of talking, interacting with each other. Like, to a certain extent, it's a funnier movie if someone, like, murders someone over a microaggression than if, like, some dumbass slits his own throat with his father's champagne saber trying to make a TikTok video.
But isn't part of the point that they're all too pathetic to be murderous?
Maybe. I mean, but they do end up killing people. Like, you know. Where the movie's real missed opportunity comes in, I think, is that you have two characters who ostensibly are sort of outside of this milieu, right? You have Greg, the older, like, veterinarian who's of a different generation. And then you have Bea, who, for class reasons, should be, like, sort of entirely outside of and alien to this vibe whatsoever. And the movie never engages at all with the question of how they feel about, like, this sort of language and way of speaking and relating to each other, right?
I disagree. I disagree with that pretty strongly. I mean, there's that whole sequence where the Lee Pace character, Greg, is like, oh, I get it. You guys are fucking with me. Like when Pete Davidson is, like, mocking him to his face, like, trying to get him to explain the, like, common sports metaphor that he has deployed. And that is part of the whole thing. But also, like, I thought they did a very good job with B showing somebody who was an outsider without I don't know, making it too obvious that was going on. I mean, the whole sequence with the zucchini bread and, like, you know, she shows up to this party.
They play with the differences about her and class, but not in a way that specifically plays into the extent to which this is language that has been sort of adopted and weaponized by people from a very specific class position, right? Like, there are ways in which she doesn't fit in, or which she's comfortable, you know, or which she's uncomfortable. She gets accused of sort of lying about her background, and it turns out it's because she didn't graduate from college and she's embarrassed about it. But I don't think Maria Bakalova is very good in this, to be perfectly honest. I find her sort of flat and unengaged. And I think part of that is, like, you get just no hint of a reaction to this specific language that is class coded. And the fact that there is the sort of other points of friction make the lack of engagement there stand out.
But isn't the movie trying to say that the rich dipshits have passed this sort of thing down to everybody else, the college strivers who drop out, right? Like, the movie starts with B and with the two girls, like, texting in parallel, right, next to each other, right? Like, so that we understand that they are both participants in this sort of, like, totally obsessive messaging, like, can't look away from my phone culture.
There is a gap here, again, between, like, the technology is clearly universal, but the language is not, right? And there is a confusion in this movie between the critique of language and the way of relating to each other and sort of technology and social media. And those two things sometimes feed each other, but they're not connected in the movie. And that critique is not made explicit. I think the scene that is just all the girls yelling at each other in, like, they're a Twitter fight come to life is quite funny, but the movie is not, that spirit is not quite sort of infused through the movie in a way that is consistent and masterful. Like, this movie's fun, but I don't think, and it may well end up being a harbinger, but the idea that it's like, you know, a sort of deeply developed critique of all of this stuff just strikes me as wrong.
I mean, I think that the fact that Maria Bakalova's character doesn't engage on this language level with any of them in any way is I think an important part of the movie. I mean, she is watching these arguments play out and not really participating at all, because this is a milieu beyond class that is unfamiliar to her. That's like not the language she uses. There's that sequence where she mentions that her mother is borderline personality disorder, and one of the other girls is like, "Oh my god, that, you know, I myself
body dysmorphia
been diagnosed with body dysmorphia," and she doesn't react to that, because there's like, how, if you are like a person who has like an actual crazy person in your family, how do you handle like the Twitter person saying, you know, I actually have mental health issues as well? Like it's a different sort of thing. I mean, this is, in a way, she is serving as the audience surrogate here to like show the craziness of it all.
I don't know. I don't think to me the non-reactivity did not serve that purpose in the way I guess you guys experienced it. I found the writing for her, I think she's just kind of a non-character, and I thought the performance didn't bring out any particular nuances in it.
I think one thing we can all agree on is that sorting off a champagne cork is really cool.
That is really cool. I mean, it's really a indictment on Pete Davidson's character.
I have, in fact, done that on video and posted it on social media. So I really...
On TikTok?
I relate. I will say, so I like this movie a lot. At the same time, I don't entirely disagree with Alyssa here. I think that if there's the biggest weakness to me was a slight over-reliance on just sort of using and name-checking like well-known sort of Twitter bullshit words.
Terms.
Right.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, we said toxic, now laugh. And they're like, it's mostly pretty well done. At the same time, like, that's a lot of the joke, how the jokes play out in this movie. And there's 10% too much of that. And I wanted something that actually sort of like, that dug into how that, you know, that's developed the specific jokes about the specific words a little bit more. Because it did seem to just sort of be like, hey, we're gonna use that word that you know that is overused, like Pete Davidson says in that opening bit. And I just felt like there's like the script wasn't bad and was actually quite clever in a lot of ways. At the same time, there's one more pass on this draft might have made like a really, really sharp film, whereas this one is very fun. Very funny, quite pointed in a lot of ways, and I think like telling in its, you know, its kind of ideological or non-ideological leanings, but doesn't quite get all the way to like, oh man, this is just perfectly skewered what it's, you know, its targets.
If there's one more thing that bothers me, I have no sense in this movie of why Bea and Sophie are together. Just none. I have no idea what they like about each other. You know, and maybe the whole point is supposed to be it's like all of these people are in like such new relationships that they're all just in like the sex haze. But like, I have no idea how they met. I have no idea like what. There is nothing there. And for this to be like a sort of operatic relationship, like, it just does not land at all for me. And Mahala Harold, I mean, I think like really, you get, like, she and Amanda Stanberg have, like, real chemistry in the movie. You can see the sort of, like, anger and attraction there. And to have the central relationship be so inert really, I think, like, puts kind of a damper on the movie.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, this is kind of Bakalova not quite being as strong as she maybe could have been. In the movie, I don't disagree with that exactly. Except I also don't really care. I mean, like, it's a bunch of 20-somethings, like 20-somethings being attracted to each other. It's just like, okay, I don't know, man. Kids these days. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Bodies, Bodies, Bodies? Peter?
I think all those kids are spending too much time on Netflix and it's making them lonely. And it's a good movie.
Alyssa?
A thumbs up. It's diverting.
Thumbs up. It's very good. All right, that's it for this week's show. Make sure to swing by atma.thebulwark.com for our bonus episode on Friday. Make sure to tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SonnyBunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.